In the eyes of many Americans, it was a terrible, outrageous abuse of power. 28-year-old George Zimmerman pulled the trigger, and a 17-year-old black youth, Trayvon Martin, was dead. Americans screamed at this event when it occurred in 2012, and they were incensed a year later when Zimmerman was acquitted in 2013, for it appeared that the power of a gun was used to create yet another victim of a black teenager. We hate even the appearance of an abuse of power. Our hatred for abuse of power has a long history. We were furious when we heard a short while back that Jerry Sandusky, a football coach with Penn State University, had for decades abused his position as a coach and sexually assaulted football players in the shower room. We hate the abuse of power. We were incensed to hear of a president a while back who used the power of his office to engage in a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. We were speechless as story after story came out in the 80s and 90s of Catholic priests who abused the power and position that was theirs in order to sexually harass and molest children under their ministries. We hate the abuse of power. And even today, we remain anxious about a government that's being accused of rampant wiretapping, of data mining, of eavesdropping, and of torturing people in places like Guantanamo Bay. Even the thought that power could be used for illegitimate means to give some people gain and create victims of others, that thought fills us with anger. It's deeply rooted in us. For indeed, our whole government is built to protect us from abuse of power. There is the executive branch and the congressional branch and the judicial branch that were all strategically developed so that they might check the power of each other and never be able to run over and abuse their power, misuse their position, and create victims in this great land. We hate the abuse of power. And while it certainly angers us to see it in the world around us, when we are honest with ourselves, we admit that we also are tempted to abuse the very power and position that God has given to us. Deep within us, there is this desire to use our power over people, the positions that we've been granted, in ways that leverage us to gain advantage over others, get our own benefit, and even create victims. It happens with husbands, Christian husbands, who can use their position and power to control their wives and even abuse them. It happens with Christian moms who might use their power and position over their children to control them and gain benefit from them. It can happen to Christian supervisors and employers as we are tempted to use our position and our power to control employees and get benefits for ourselves in abuse of them. Even elderly widows and widowers can be tempted to use their position in life to control family members and caregivers and abuse their position. What should we expect will happen when we engage in such activity? If we give in to the temptation to abuse power, to misuse position, what do we think that will happen to us? This morning we want to answer that question. And we're going to spend some time investigating just how it can even happen to a believer. How is it that a person of God can fall into this temptation to abuse power that God has given to them and make victims of other people. And then we'll look at the wrong expectation, what we often expect when we think that we can, well, take care of it. And then we'll move into the right expectation, what we should expect from God when his people act like this. And then finally, some implications for today, some ideas of what it means to live out our lives with the right expectations of this very issue. So we have lots to cover. We're going to do it by looking at a story that you're probably quite familiar with on one hand, and yet we'll need fresh eyes. Because if we look in on the story of David and Bathsheba, a man of great position, great power, and he abused it. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 11, and so if you'll turn in your Bibles there, I will read for us the opening scene where God's people, in this case David himself, abused his power to get what he wanted at the expense of another. And David, I think, is actually a pattern for the way this works for people in general and for Christians even, that we can abuse the power God has given us for our benefit at the expense of another. In David's case, it results in the rape of Bathsheba. 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 1 through 4. The text reads this way. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites, besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a young woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. And David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent messengers to her. He took her. She came to him, and he slept with her. Now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanness. Then she went back home. David abused his power to get what he wanted. His first error, of course, as it points out in the text, is that it is a time when men and kings are going out to war. In fact, a war has already begun with the Ammonites. It started in the previous chapter, and David needed to finish the operation and get the job done. That was his responsibility. But instead, he sent out Joab, his general, and he waited back in Jerusalem. And David, it says, can't sleep, so he gets up and he walks out on his palace roof. And instead of just kind of casting his eye over the city, he casts his eyes downward into a courtyard where a young, beautiful woman is bathing. Now, the word here could mean that it does not necessarily mean that she was naked and bathing in public. Probably more likely that she could have well been fully covered. It's a word that can even be used for a woman who's fully covered. She's bathing in as much privacy as she can get. And David decides, I'll take her. And so he sends messengers and tries to find out who this beautiful woman is. And it's very interesting because in the text, she actually is given this qualification. Well, look what it says. It says, the man said in verse 3, she's Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. She's a somebody. David, you should recognize this woman is married to a man named Uriah, who, by the way, he's one of your best fighters, a valiant man. And this woman's other relative, the daughter of Eliam, she's somebody because Eliam is also one of your fighters. And perhaps, although it doesn't state it here, Eliam's father, Bathsheba's grandfather, may have been Ahithophel, one of your chief advisors. David, why do you want her? I want her, David says. So he sends messengers, and they bring her back. This is an act of a royal officer, a king, who takes his position and he sends his people to take this woman for himself. And though the word rape does not occur in Hebrew, we don't have it anywhere in the Bible, it really is the idea of here's a woman who's defenseless, who probably comes to the palace and has no opportunity to say no. He gets what he wants. He misused his position for his own benefit at the expense of someone else. May I pause for a moment in our story to suggest that if this can happen to David, it scares me to think that it can happen to me and to us. David, a man after God's own heart. David, a man whom God has raised up from the fields of the shepherd, as a shepherd to shepherd his people. David, a man who will write psalms that we now use for our worship. This David abused his power in such a way. And so we must recognize that this is not a temptation only for a king. In fact, the higher your position, the greater your power, the more likely that you will be tempted. The husband who wants his wife to clean the house and prepare his meals and give him sexual satisfaction, he's not getting what he wants, so he's tempted to use his physical power and his position to abuse and control, just like David. Or perhaps it's the mother who wants her kids to love her and respect her and make her look good in public by getting perfect behavior and good grades. And that mom will be tempted to abuse her power and position and verbally, perhaps, with her kids, perhaps physically abusing them, unreasonable punishment, withholding food, doing whatever to get compliance. The temptation is there for all of us. What do we expect will happen when we give in to such temptation? Well, let's look first at a wrong expectation. Here's what David expected. David expected once the deed was out, he'd be able to cover it up. He could cover his crime. He could conceal his sin. He could sweep it under the carpet and no one would know. That's what he thought. Notice how the situation became urgent for David in verse 5. Chapter 11, back in the text, verse 5, it says, "The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, I'm pregnant." Not joyful news. It's kind of interesting because to this point, David has been the man in charge. He's the guy with the royal authority. In the earlier verses, he's the one who sent Joab. He sent a messenger to inquire. He sent messengers to take. David is sending and sending and sending because he is the king. And now this word comes back that says that the woman sent word to David. I'm pregnant. And desperate, David is now desperate to control the leak. It is time for damage control. He's got to put some spin on this. He's got to do something to make sure that the public does not become aware that he has abused the power of his office. I can imagine David pacing the floor of his palace, thinking, wondering, scratching his chin. What will I do? What will I do? Then a plan. It's a sneaky, devious scheme. He knows exactly what he can do to conceal this, to cover up his crime. He'll call for her husband. And he'll get Uriah, her husband, to come and spend time with his wife. And then no one could suspect that David was the father of this illegitimate child. So that's what we read in verses 6 through 13, is David trying to conceal this sin by calling in Bathsheba's husband. Verse 6, so David sent his word to Joab. Notice again, he's sending his word out to Joab. Send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent him to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, how the war was going. Did you have a good cup of coffee at Starbucks? Let's chat for a while. And then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace and all his master's servants, with all his master's servants, and did not go down to his house. Oh. David was told Uriah did not go home. So he asked Uriah, haven't you just come from a military campaign? Why didn't you go home? What good man wouldn't want to be with his wife when he gets in from the field? Uriah says, I have higher loyalties. Uriah says to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my commander Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open country. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing. Wow. This guy, he wants to do what's right. He's a warrior. And when Israel's in danger, he cannot accept pleasure. So David, he says, well, let's try this again. Verse 12, David said to him, stay here one more day, and tomorrow I'll send you back. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. And in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants. He did not go home. Plan foiled. David's back to pacing in the palace, scheming, wondering, thinking, devising another plan. I'll send him back to the battle. I'll make sure he's killed. Indeed, the text says that the next morning, David wrote a letter to General Joab and said, hey, when Uriah comes to you on the field, be sure you put him into a position where he will be killed. And so that is exactly what happened. The conclusion of this episode comes in verses 16 and 17. So while Joab had the city under siege, this is out on the battlefield, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. Verse 17, when the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite was dead. The plan worked. We're done with it. David has to be thinking Uriah is dead. Bathsheba is now a widow. And in fact, David will even look like a hero because he can marry this woman who's pregnant with child. And it'll look like a wonderful deed that he's caring for somebody in need because she no longer has a husband. Everything's going to turn out just right. He tried to conceal his sin and cover his crime. It's kind of natural, isn't it? Watch two elementary kids out on the playground. One big kid, one little timid kid. The bigger one pushes the smaller one down. The little kid comes in because he's crying and he's been pushed off the swing. And then the big kid tells the teacher, well, it was the smaller kid. He was calling me names first. Going to cover up his crime by telling a lie. You ever notice you don't have to teach kids how to do that? It just happens. An office manager uses an email to create a scam against a subordinate to get her fired. And what does she do later? Well, she deletes the email trail, cover it up, make sure no one can blame her. The Catholic Church at upper levels knew about abusive priests for years and years, and what did they do? They moved the priests to different dioceses and different locations to cover it up. That's what we do. From elementary school to presidents, from playgrounds to Watergates, we are people who try to cover our crimes, conceal our sin. And we expect everything will be all right. That's probably what David's thinking too. Because verses 26 and 27 say that she actually became his wife. And verse 27, after the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house. She became his wife and bore him a son. Everything's good. Crime covered. Sin concealed. But that's the wrong expectation. David is about to learn there's a different expectation he should have. The right expectation is that when God's people abuse the power he's given them, when they misuse the position he has provided for them, then they can expect measured judgment from God. They can expect measured justice from God. And that's what David is about to learn, and that's what is helpful for us as well. Follow along as we continue the story in chapter 12. First of all, verses 1 through 4. Well, actually, back to chapter 11. Notice how the end of the chapter, the last statement of chapter 11. But the thing David had done, literally, was evil in the eyes of the Lord. That's the turning point. Everything will now change because the Lord has seen. So, the Lord sent Nathan to David. Nathan, you'll recall, is the prophet, the advisor. And he came to him and he said, there were two men. I'm going to tell you a story, David. There were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food. It drank from his cup. It even slept in his arms. It lied in his arms. It laid there in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. What a wonderful little story about affection and caring and concern. You see this bond between a little sheep and this man. Now, a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. Here was a blatant thief who stole a beloved lamb from a poor man. David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." And Nathan said to David, "You are the man." This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. "I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul, and I gave your master's house to you, and I gave your master's wives into your arms. I gave you all Israel and Judah, and all If all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why? Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household, I am going to bring literally evil calamity on you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will sleep with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I'll do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel." And David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." Nathan replied, "The Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die. But because you are doing this, you have shown utter contempt for the Lord. The son born to you will die." Wow. David would receive from God his measured justice. In the verses that follow, the author will tell us that David fasted and prayed, hoping that God would change his mind and relent, but God did not. A son indeed was born. And at the end of this chapter, it tells us how that son died. It must have been a terrible thing for David to look at this, to hear this, and realize that only a short time earlier, he had heard from the words of the same prophet that a son would be born to him out of his own body, who would reign on the throne forever. And here's a son born from his own body who is executed by God because of his sin. I'd suggest to you that this is a measured justice from God. It's measured in three different ways. Let me kind of quickly give you a couple of, give you these three ways that God measures out the justice. First of all, God sees it, and he evaluates it properly. He assesses it as heinous, atrocious, terrible, dreadful, evil. I noted at the end of chapter 11, verse 27, this is evil in the Lord's sight. That's the central hinge of the whole story. Everything changes on this. When you come to chapter 12 and verse 9, notice what it says there as well. Why do you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? David had not considered it evil at all. Back in chapter 11, verse 25, we didn't read that, but if you go back and study it later, you'll see that David had sent word to Joab. And when Joab had made sure that Uriah was killed in battle, here's what David said: don't let it be evil in your eyes. God says, it's evil in my eyes to do this kind of thing. You see, God has a scale. Reminds me of a tachometer in my car. Those of you who are car junkies know that a tachometer measures the speed of your engine, not the speed of the car, but the revolutions per minute that your engine is turning. And cars are only built to have your engine turn so fast. And if you go too fast in a certain gear, that tachometer will go across what is called a red line. And to redline your engine is to put it in danger. It's to say, you're redlining it, you're going to blow it up. God looks at David's evil and says, you're redlining. You're over the top. This is atrocious. You're on a pathway to destroy yourself. Uriah is pictured here as someone so much better than David. He's a foreigner. David's an Israelite. He's a warrior. David's a king. He won't lie with his wife. David does lie with his wife. He won't engage in pleasure. David seeks pleasure. Uriah, a foreigner, shows David how evil he really is. God assesses this crime, and he calls it evil. There's a second way that this is measured justice. We'd call it talionic justice. It's the punishment fits the crime. This is the eye for the eye and the tooth for the tooth. David gets exactly what he deserves. Did you notice it as we read through here? It says that he struck down people with the sword, struck down Uriah with the sword, verse 9. So the sword will not leave your house, verse 10. You've done evil, so I will raise up evil in your house. That's verse 11. Verse 11, since David slept with Bathsheba, others would sleep with his wives. Since David had done this in secret, God will do this openly. Even in Nathan's story, do you remember what David said? That man should pay for the taking of this sheep with four sheep. That's actually part of Mosaic law. And in the chapters that come, we're going to find that four sons of David are going to be killed. Four sheep will be required of him. His punishment fits the crime. It's measured and it's severe because the crime is severe. There's a third way this justice is measured. He measures his justice with mercy along the way. For God does forgive his son, his sin, and then a second son is born. And at the end of this chapter, verse 24, Chapter 12, verse 24. David comforted his wife Bathsheba. He went to her and made love to her. She gave birth to a son. They named him Solomon. The Lord loved him. And because the Lord loved him, he sent word through Nathan the prophet to name him Jedidiah, loved of God. It's measured justice. God doesn't just retaliate. He remembers his covenant. A son will build a house for me. This is not a God who's just angry and vengeful. It's a God who gives, he's a God who gives measured justice. Justice with mercy. Perhaps for us it's hard to believe that we will receive God's measured justice. You've never had Nathan come and speak to you. But could it be that some of our sickness, hardships, tragedies, death in our families, could it be that sometimes we are receiving the measured justice of God? We must expect that our abuse of power lines us up for God to defend his name and send measured justice our way. When we abuse our power position that God has given us, we cannot expect to cover up the crime. Can't expect to conceal the sin. We must expect that God will bring measured justice for his people, for his name. Now, if we believe that, if you buy it, if it gets us in our gut, how will we live? I think we will live with an expectation of measured justice from God. Some of us are in positions with power. And what that means for us is we must refrain. We must be constantly vigilant about using our power, using our position in such a way that we would abuse it to control others, turn them into victims, and act like we are somehow God ourselves. Refrain from the abuse of power. If you're a husband tempted to use your power to control your wife, because you believe that God will bring measured justice, you will refrain from such abuse of power. You'll do it. Some of us, if you're a mom, you may be tempted to use that power over your kids to control them and get what you want. But you believe that God will send measured justice. And so you refrain from abusing your power and position. If you're a supervisor in your workplace, you could find yourself tempted to use your power and position to control your employees or the people under you. But you know that what to expect is God's measured justice coming your way. So you'll refrain from misusing that power. You could even be an elderly person in your family, a widow or a widower, and as the family's matriarch or patriarch, you can use that power and position to control caregivers and control family members. But because you expect measured justice from God, you'll refrain. You won't do it. Some of you here this morning, you say, I don't feel like a person of power. I don't feel like a person of position. I feel more like a victim. I feel like the person who's been abused. But for you as well, there is an opportunity to expect the measured justice of God. For we wait. As victims, we wait for God to bring his justice. This is hard because when we're a victim, we want power. Often we want power so we can get even and get back. My friend, even if you find yourself in a situation like Bathsheba, the mentality that God wants for his people is to believe that he will bring justice, measured justice, on those who perpetrate such evil. In 1998, the world learned about President Clinton's abuse of power as he had an inappropriate sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. I was in Kenya at that time and Ethiopia, and when the news broke, it was quite an international news story. Of course, CNN and Sky News, and if you've traveled overseas, you know how American stories have their own life when you get overseas. And I'll never forget being around a bunch of internationals in both those countries and over those months when that news was hitting the airwaves. And people looked at me and they said, "Why all the hubbub? Why are you Americans making such a big deal out of this? What's our president? He's abusing power." And they all said back to me, "Well, that's what we expect from our leaders." My friends, the world around us lives on and dies with abuse of power and misuse of power, position. We are different. By God's grace, may we be different. And so, our Father, I would ask for all of us your grace upon us. I would ask that you would help us to live with this constant expectation that if we succumb to the temptation to abuse the position and power you've given to us, we can expect measured justice from you. We want to have the fear of the Lord. And yet we recognize as well that this is for us an encouragement. For justice is in your hands. And we thank you. Father, as we turn to celebrate a king who will come, who will be so much better than David, as we envision that day when he will come and reign with justice himself, I ask that you would increase our faith and accept our worship for Jesus' sake. Amen.